Good morning, and welcome to What Clinicians Want to Know, addressing current questions and controversies in the management of chronic lymphocytic leukemia. I'm Dr. Jeff Sharman, and I'll be moderating today's event. This is our faculty today, and we've got a great cast of characters here. So on my left and moving further, we have Bill Weirda from MD Anderson, Bita Fakhri from Stanford. We've got Farouk Awan from University of Texas Southwestern, and then Kerry Rogers from The Ohio State. Here are relevant faculty conflicts of interest. We'll flip through these. All right. So here is the commercial support for today's Research to Practice, and we're grateful to our sponsors for enabling this event. This program will contain discussions of non-approved uses of agents and regimens. Please refer to the official prescribing information for each product and its approved indications. This is where we're headed today. I'll start out talking about first-line therapy. Dr. Rogers will discuss BTK inhibitors in combination with BCL2 inhibitors. Dr. Awan will cover safety in special patient populations. Dr. Fakhri will walk us through the non-covalent BTK inhibitors, and Dr. Weirda will finish talking about CAR-T and other developing novel strategies. Here's some data from the General Medical Oncologist Survey. This shows the level of interest in topics related to CLL, and these are the topics we're hoping to address up here for your education today. All right, so we'll go ahead and kick off here with Module 1. This is my set of slides. All right, so I'll be talking about considerations in frontline chronic lymphocytic leukemia. The IWCLL criteria have been long established and really determined when we treat. Now, this slide isn't designed to be read. I realize the text is small, but I just want to highlight the key features. Indications for therapy include progressive marrow dysfunction manifest by a hemoglobin dropping less than 10 or platelets dropping under 100, massive splenomegaly or massive lymph nodes, progressive lymphocytosis. You know, I always say it's really important. It's not that there's a single number that tells us when to treat. There's no magic threshold of 100 or anything like that, but it's the velocity of change. And so when we see that doubling in less than 6 months, that's our clue for treatment. Autoimmune complications can be an indication for therapy. And I think one of the ones that's sometimes missed is the symptomatic or functional extranodal involvement. I just recently had a patient present unusual case with renal failure and had direct renal involvement. CLL can be a tissue-invasive disease, and it's important to keep that in mind. And then finally, disease-related symptoms such as fatigue, night sweats, and so forth. The question of when to treat has been long a question mark in CLL and has been addressed through multiple studies throughout the years. These studies were oftentimes conducted well before they were eventually published, but we had the original chlorambucil versus watch and wait. We had fludarabine versus watch and wait in the original German CLL1 study. And then the CLL7 study looked at FCR versus watch and wait. And you can see the dates in which these were published. But we're now 10 years into the targeted era therapy. Note that ibrutinib was approved just about 10 years ago. And it brings us to the CLL12 study, another German study, very well conducted, that asks the question, does early intervention with ibrutinib lead to better outcomes? And I think this highlights some of the challenge in CLL, because if you sort of start in the top right and work your way around counterclockwise, sure, if you put somebody on ibrutinib versus placebo, you greatly improve progression-free survival. The event-free survival, which is, you know, disease progression with indication for treatment, death, or new treatment, that's going to be a whole lot better. Time to next treatment is going to be a whole lot better. But we still don't change overall survival. And if we're going to consider intervening earlier, that's really going to be the gold standard that we have to consider. But I'll also note that these drugs, although they're oral, and although it's a great advance in our tolerability, no drug is a free lunch. So each of these drugs has side effects. And while we as clinicians oftentimes focus on the grade 3 adverse events, it's really living with the day-to-day grade 1-2 events on top that our patients complain about most, and that's arthralgias atrial fibrillation, GI toxicity, hypertension, and so forth. So what does that leave us right now? Where are we with frontline BTK options? We've had updates of the original RESONATE 2 study. Now, ibrutinib has been compared across a variety of regimens, bendamustine rituximab, FCR, ibrutinib with obinutuzumab. I select the RESONATE 2 study because it has the longest follow-up. This was recently updated at European Hematology Association. I didn't have that slide. But the key thing I would highlight here towards the tail of the curve is we now have a median. And patients always ask, how long am I going to be on this drug? And no matter, or they say, am I going to be on this drug forever? And I think we can now say we have an answer. So the typical patient is on therapy for about 9 to 10 years. And I think that that's useful to a patient to be able to give them that real finite duration of therapy. On the right, we see the responses, and I would highlight that the green is the complete responses, and they continue to improve with time. What about acalabrutinib? This is from last year's ASH update of the ELEVATE-TN. This was a three-arm study in which obinutuzumab chlorambucil, here along the bottom, was compared with acalabrutinib versus acalabrutinib obinutuzumab. When the study was first released right around here, there was really no difference between the acalabrutinib with or without obinutuzumab, and that was consistent with other studies. But the surprise with longer follow-up on this study is that 6 months of obinutuzumab early on leads to a growing improvement in outcomes over time. And I think it's one of the topics to discuss today is whether or not adding CD20 antibodies to BTK makes sense. Now there's one data point I'm gonna highlight here for future slides here, which is if you look at the 5-year follow-up of acalabrutinib monotherapy, it's right here, just about 80% in this older population. And you'll see why that's important here in a couple slides. So should obinutuzumab be included? We did analysis where we looked at the depth of response. Essentially, if you got a complete response, whether that was with acalabrutinib monotherapy or acalabrutinib in combination with obinutuzumab, how was your outcome? And in blue are the patients who got a complete response, and in yellow are the patients who got less than a complete response. And you can see that the depth of response actually makes a difference, which is somewhat different from our prior understanding of how BTK inhibitors work. On the left side of the figure here is the response rate over time for the addition of obinutuzumab versus monotherapy. And what you can see is that the complete responses shown here in light blue are better than the ones in purple. The patients who had obinutuzumab added do get deeper responses, and even with the benefit of time, the patients on monotherapy don't catch up. So I'm particularly excited. This is one of my colleagues' presentations here at ASH this year, is giving acalabrutinib obinutuzumab for fixed duration. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk with Bill about that presentation later. So what about zanubrutinib? This is a study that surprised exactly nobody, which is that zanubrutinib is better than bendamustine rituximab, but it did lead to the label. This is being presented at ASH this year, and I'll say that the 5-year update shows just about an 80% PFS with zanubrutinib, which is pretty close to what we saw for acalabrutinib as well, slightly different patient populations. How do we pick a BTK agent? Well, there have been two studies in the relapse setting. On the left is acalabrutinib versus ibrutinib, and on the right is zanubrutinib versus ibrutinib. Now, I don't know how many match-adjusted indirect comparisons we need to see. A lot of people want to compare if C beats A, but B doesn't beat A, does C by therefore definition beat B? I think that's a flawed comparison because these are very different patient populations. They were done at different times, and I, for one, have not really bought on these match-adjusted indirect comparisons. So what does NCCN show us? That's here. You can see the preferred regimens. Really, acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, what they did offer was a toxicity advantage, and so you see these as the preferred regimens, with ibrutinib listed as another regimen. What about BCL2 inhibitors in frontline CLL? The big study for this one was the German CLL14 study, which compared obinutuzumab venetoclax versus obinutuzumab chlorambucil. That one handily. This was just recently updated. And I think the key here is this part of the curve, where you see Gosh, we're right around six and a half years for the median time to progression. Now, that is with 1 year of fixed duration therapy. If you separate it by their IGHV status, though, you see an important finding that what's driving the progressions are those patients with IGHV unmutated disease. I'm going to skip this because I think I'm getting behind already, but I think that the time to next treatment is another important aspect of this. Just because somebody progresses doesn't necessarily mean that they're going on to another therapy. And so when I see a patient with frontline CLL, I can say, look, right around the 6 year mark, you're still about 70% of patients don't need another therapy, which I think is, again, really impressive. And you can see that stratified further by whether or not they're IGHV mutated or not. So my default regimen, all other considerations in an IGHV mutated patient, oftentimes is the obinutuzumab venetoclax because of the duration of benefit. And I think that there's a more nuanced conversation amongst my patients with IGHV unmutated disease. CLL14 was an elderly population, and so this was studied in a younger group as well, and I think Dr. Rogers has some slides here as well, but this looked at triplet with ibrutinib, obinutuzumab, venetoclax, obinutuzumab, venetoclax in red, rituximab, venetoclax, or chemoimmunotherapy. I think the key highlight here is that proving once again obinutuzumab is better than rituximab in CLL. And I think at this tail end of the curve, we're seeing some separation, which is an interesting thing we can talk about with the addition of triplet therapy. There are a couple ASH updates that speak to this as well. We'll be presenting the Cristallo study, which looks at obinutuzumab venetoclax and versus chemoimmunotherapy, depth of response, as well as MRD-adapted therapy. So factors to consider. I think that with BTK inhibitors, there certainly is convenience. There's really long-term efficacy data. I realize this slide's actually a little bit outdated and probably needs to be updated because both have been compared to FCR and BR. And there is probably more data for the efficacy of venetoclax at the time of ibrutinib progression. For obinutuzumab venetoclax, we have potentially for one year time-limited therapy, there's a favorable cardiac profile and less concern for long-term adherence, as well as some potential cost savings. So that brings us to the end of my discussion, and we have a couple questions, and I'm going to just start to my left with Bill. I think this first question is a very specific patient, but I guess I would ask you to highlight sort of the broader themes about molecular characteristics. How do you think about both older and younger patients with high-risk disease?
Okay, so an 80-year-old with high-risk disease, as you say, by virtue of having an unmutated immunoglobulin gene and a mutated TP53, puts that patient in a category where I'm a little uncomfortable having them off treatment, so my preference for that type of patients would be to have them on a maintenance type strategy with a BTK inhibitor. The challenge with the BTK inhibitors potentially in that older patient population are the side effects and toxicities, the cardiac toxicities, etc. So for an 80-year-old with unmutated V gene and TP53, I would favor a second generation BTK inhibitor as a maintenance strategy, acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib, over a fixed duration venetoclax based therapy. If they're younger, it's a different story. And I'm in favor of combined targeted therapies for patients with those features who are younger, as, for example, a patient with 50, who's 55.
Yeah, Carrie, I'm going to come to you next. When you have a young patient who walks in your door with high-risk disease, I think one of the thoughts is, what am I going to treat this patient with now? But it's really even more, how do I think about this patient in long-term? I'm curious how you counsel your younger patients with high-risk disease in terms of sequencing and so forth.
Yeah, that I think is an outstanding point because when you have someone who's older, their natural lifespan's probably not 3 decades if you're 80, and it definitely might be for someone who's 55. And so you have to think about not just the benefit of the first treatment, but what's going to happen down the line. What we've seen with initial BTK inhibitor monotherapy is that patients with TP53 disruption, so either deletion 17P or TP53 mutations, have the same progression-free survival as patients that has CLL that doesn't have those high-risk features. So to maximize the benefit of first-line treatment is really to do BTK inhibitor as a continuous treatment strategy. However, you would expect then that someone who is able to be on the BTK inhibitor that doesn't stop for toxicity would have disease that's resistant to the BTK inhibitor at the end of that time, which again is close to 9 years as a median. And then you have a shorter median progression-free survival for venetoclax in that setting of maybe 2 years. So I always think about that whole sequence and hoping that we'll have more drugs then. I also talk to younger patients about the ultimate need, you know, in the future for things like CAR T cell therapy and such, because this is someone where we don't currently have enough therapies to keep their CLL in control for their natural lifespan. And I think there's a good discussion now where we see shorter progression-free survival with these fixed duration combinations, both venetoclax and obinutuzumab and BTK inhibitor venetoclax, but it would allow someone to have time off treatment. So for a younger patient, they might want something that they'd expect a shorter progression-free survival than in patients without high-risk disease, knowing that they'll have an opportunity to at least spend some time off treatment. So I think you have to really talk about what they might expect in their lifespan and discuss maximizing the benefit of the first therapy with a BTK inhibitor or doing a combination knowing that they'll have some time off treatment, but it's likely the disease control would be shorter for them with high-risk disease.
Thank you. Farouk, amongst the molecular tests that are just maybe not as frequently performed sort of in the general practice, is the IGHV mutated, unmutated status. I mean, I think people have gotten better with using FISH, but IGHV status is maybe less heavily utilized. And I'm curious how that test influences how you think about frontline therapy.
So I think I look at those in combination with the FISH and the TP53 mutation analysis. I think the other thing that we don't see a lot being tested is the TP53 mutation along with the FISH. Luckily, our use in the US, I should say, for the international audience, it might be different, but in the US, the use has improved for FISH over the years. It used to be around 10, 12, 15%. Now it's probably close to 50, 60%, unfortunately. IGHV has always been around 10, 12%. Which is dismal, because you were making the argument that I will use chemotherapy for my CLL patients with mutated disease, because that was the argument for using FCR for the longest time, even with BTK inhibitors. And unfortunately, all of those patients who got chemotherapy and are still getting chemotherapy don't know if they are mutated for IGHV or not. So that was one of the reasons why every time we go out and talk about it, we do talk about IGHV and the significance of IGHV, and I think it's still relevant. It's probably the only other thing that's relevant, as you just showed, that in patients treated with venetoclax, they do have a slightly inferior outcome with unmutated disease. Those patients also might be more likely to get more clonal evolution over the years. So if I'm discussing infinite therapy versus finite therapy, I do talk about possibly leaning towards the BTK inhibitors if you are IGHV unmutated, rather than doing a venetoclax or obinutuzumab-based approach. So that's where I use it personally. Outside of that trivial thing, the other reason I use it, and so when do we test it? Do we test it every time? Do we test it once? I do test it on all our patients up front, because once it's mutated, it's always mutated. Once you're unmutated, you're always unmutated. The reason why I test it up front personally is it gives me an idea of when to follow this person, because the mutated one, I will be more comfortable in seeing them in 6 months. Even if I don't do the formal CLL IPI score, I can still assume that the vast majority of my mutated patients, I can see them every 6 months or once a year. But for the unmutated, maybe I might need to see them sooner. And keep a closer eye on those patients because they're more likely to progress. So those are kind of the subtle things that I also use the IGHV to help guide my management.
Thank you. Pete, I'm coming to you, but I'm switching the question. So if you were getting ready to, which is picking amongst BTK inhibitors, frontline setting, relapse, I guess it doesn't really matter, but how do you think about which BTK agent to use and what motivates you one way or the other?
So between ibrutinib and the new generation, acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, I think We are living in an era that we have the luxury of these new generation BTK inhibitors. I think the field owes so much to ibrutinib, but you know, the side effect profile compared to the new ones is less favorable. So I think we've moved from ibrutinib in choosing a BTK inhibitor, a covalent BTK inhibitor for a patient with either treatment naive or relapse refractory disease. But between acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, as you mentioned, so zanu has been compared in the Alpine trial to ibrutinib, and acalabrutinib has also been compared to ibrutinib in the ELEVATE-RR trial. So zanu and acalabrutinib have not been compared in a head-to-head fashion, and I share your sentiment that I'm not basically convinced by matched-adjusted indirect comparisons. So honestly, between zanu and acalabrutinib, my honest answer is I toss a coin. But there are some caveats to that. You know, zanu, we know that it is associated with a higher rate of neutropenia. So if a patient is coming in with, you know, heavily infiltrated marrow and presenting with neutropenia, I am mostly inclined toward using acalabrutinib. And, you know, between acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, acalabrutinib is associated with a higher rate of headache, which is, you know, temporary, self-resolves after 3-4 cycles, very caffeine responsive. But if someone has really bad headaches, migraine headaches, lupus with CNS involvement, those are the scenarios that I've used zanubrutinib versus acalabrutinib. And I have to tell you, in real life practice, I have chosen one, acalabrutinib versus zanu, or zanu versus acalabrutinib, and then the insurance has gotten back to me that you have to switch to the other one.
Great. Bill, while I formulate my questions from this slide, I just want to ask you about the CD20 with BTK. I know I'm a little bit in the minority on this, but if you wouldn't mind just sort of summarizing what you think the role of CD20 is in addition to BTK.
Sure. Because of the data you showed with the acalabrutinib CD20 antibody, it gets our attention. It's a topic of discussion. Traditionally, I have thought about BTK inhibitor as monotherapy, not necessarily with a CD20 antibody. As we emerge from the COVID period, we're a little bit more inclined to think about a CD20 antibody. It is immunosuppressive. We have an increased risk for infection with a CD20 antibody. At this ASH, it's a little bit remarkable to me because a lot of the data that we'll see on the big trials will show COVID-related deaths, and they tend to be among patients who got a CD20 antibody. Given that, I think the concept of having a maintenance where you can show that the depth of remission is important is a very important concept for us. I use a CD20 antibody currently with a BTK inhibitor if I have a patient who presents with very active disease, high white count, very low hemoglobin, where I want to get control of their disease a bit quicker, and I want to avoid things that happen when we put patients on BTK inhibitor, like a higher white count, et cetera. So I don't usually give 6 cycles when I give maintenance BTK. I give 3 cycles perhaps to get things under better control, and then I'll just continue with the BTK inhibitor.
Carrie, I'm coming to you. You know, I think it was so shocking when the original studies of BTK were done to see these lymphocytosis. We had to rewrite the criteria for what progression was. Are there any, I think a common question that comes up is, how high do I let this go? How long does it take to come down? Do you have any color to shed on that?
Yeah, so BTK inhibitor-associated lymphocytosis, most patients get, especially you see this in the initial treatment setting where people have a higher disease burden, and you really, I describe it to patients as having all the CLL cells leave the lymph nodes in the bone marrow and go into the blood. Because you see the lymph nodes go down, patients feel better, and they're shocked because their white count has doubled. So I prepare them for this. I do not have any particular number with white count where I get worried, because those cells don't really hurt the patient. I'm not going to lie, around 700,000, I do start to get a little nervous. But it's really fine to have the white count get that high, and you do see it come down over time. And that takes variable lengths, including, like, you'll see prolonged lymphocytosis where the lymphocyte count 3 or 4 years in comes down and then sticks right at, like, 1,200. So it just, it's okay to have these cells in the blood, and I never worry, as long as the other disease markers are improving, if the lymphocyte count stays high for months and really doesn't come down a lot until a year, or is there still extra lymphocytes years into treatment. You know, if the hemoglobin and platelets are good, the lymph nodes are good, the patient's doing well. And there was actually an analysis done a while ago showing that prolonged lymphocytosis really was a marker of people that ended up with a better progression-free survival. The thing that makes me worry, of course, is if people are adherent to taking a BTK inhibitor and you see the lymphocyte count come down, stays down for like 2 years, and then starts going up again, then you're like, okay, well, that probably means that the CLL is becoming resistant to the BTK inhibitor. But really, the treatment-related lymphocytosis doesn't bother me at all in an otherwise responding patient.
Super. I don't know if my next question could be answered in 20 seconds or less, so I think we'll move on to module number 2 here. Dr. Rogers, I'm coming back to you here. Can you walk us through your slides on the emerging role of BTK inhibitors in combination with BCL2 inhibitors?
Yes, thank you. So I'll just start by saying that these combinations are not approved in the U.S., but I want to provide you with an overview of some of the more mature studies and newer ones with these combinations, because I do think these are highly effective treatments. Just to cover the rationale for why these studies are done, other than just we have two effective drugs and should combine them, is that BTK inhibition does sensitize CLL cells to BCL2 inhibition. One mechanism is by decreasing other anti-apoptotic proteins, and we know that mitochondrial BCL2 dependence increases in the presence of BTK inhibitors, resulting in greater sensitivity to this. And I think some of the laboratory work that's been done is great, but underplays just how effective these drugs are in combination in the clinic. There is also a really neat analysis showing that the BTK inhibitor, specifically ibrutinib, attack more, have a better effect on dividing cells, and that the BCL2 inhibitor venetoclax really hits more of the resting CLL cell population to result in better cell killing and deeper remission. So I think that's kind of intriguing as well. But really, based on some of this rationale, there's now a variety of studies looking at BTK inhibitor and BCL2 inhibitor combinations. And of course, true to form in oncology, every time you've got an effective kind of base drug, adding an antibody that has a different mechanism does seem to result in improvements. I think with the BTK inhibitor, anti-CD20, there's a lot of discussion around what they add there, but usually adding a CD20 helps. So there are now doublet BTK inhibitor, BCL2 inhibitor, and triplet with addition of antibody studies, and I'm going to show you just some of them. So there's a lot of studies looking at ibrutinib and venetoclax, or IV. I'm just showing you a phase 3 study that was done in older or less fit patients, so it had a comparison of chlorambucil and obinutuzumab. This regimen is approved by the EMA, but not the FDA in the United States. But there is mature follow-up, and we're going to get an update on this study at this meeting on Saturday. So I'm showing you an image from their prior publication, not the data from this meeting. But they're now reporting a 60-month progression-free survival of close to 60%. So that is quite good. And there was a lot of toxicity in this older population, particularly with ibrutinib. But this is a longer follow-up showing really that this can keep people in remission. And this was a fixed duration 15-cycle combination regimen. And of course, unsurprising to anyone, the progression-free survival does remain improved compared to obinutuzumab and chlorambucil. I don't think that's a shocker. There is data with a triplet, and I wanted to include this not just because it was a study done at my institution, but this is actually the most mature study of a BTK inhibitor, BCL2 inhibitor combination, and this one's a triplet with obinutuzumab. It's a phase 2 study, so there's a complex number of cohorts. There's actually two of them in untreated patients, and this is a 14-cycle regimen that you can see diagrammed. And the reason I included this is that with follow-up, we've actually hit a median progression-free survival in treatment-naive patients, which was 7.4 years. Granted, it's a smaller sample size than a phase 3, but this puts this triplet combination as a median PFS somewhere between BTK inhibitors, which were close to 9 years, and ven-obin, which was close to 6.5. This has been looked at in a cooperative group study that is reported, and this was in older patients comparing it to ibrutinib and obinutuzumab. So the difference here was inclusion of venetoclax, and it did have an MRD-guided discontinuation. The primary endpoint was PFS and was powered for superiority, which is important because this study actually met futility and was reported at ASCO in 23, showing that the three-drug combination would not be superior to the two-drug, although they do look kind of even if you look at the hazard ratio. And there's a similar study in younger patients powered for non-inferiority, which is important because with a fixed-duration three-drug combination, if the PFS is not inferior, there'd be some benefit to doing a fixed-duration therapy here. This did have a large impact of COVID-19 deaths. You can see the PFS curves are both higher if you censor COVID-19-related deaths and come together more. The red arms, the one only had two drugs, so it looks like the third drug might have some difference related to COVID-19 deaths with venetoclax. This is kind of a different scheme, so this is a very nice study from the German CLL study group looking at venetoclax regimens, and Jeff was showing you this kind of looking at the Ven-Obin angle, but this has a three-drug arm too, and in the IVO arm, so again, the difference here is the addition of ibrutinib to venetoclax obinutuzumab, which was, again, not the main reason for the study, but an interesting analysis. You see certainly both Ven-Obin and IVO are better than chemoimmunotherapy, but you do see an emerging benefit where there's a longer PFS in specifically unmutated patients with the three drugs. So I would like to see further follow-up on this, and this was not what the study was designed to show, but it is intriguing that adding ibrutinib in IGHV unmutated CLL patients might have a benefit. Now I bring you to the study that I think I was most interested in, and the only one I know of answering the question of two versus three drugs here. So this is the AMPLIFY study, which will be presented Monday at this meeting for the full data. This is just the design and some data that was released in the abstract. The main point of the study was to compare a fixed duration AV, which is acalabrutinib venetoclax, to chemoimmunotherapy comparator. However, there's another arm that has obinutuzumab added to the AV fixed duration for AVO. So this is the only study where it's plus minus an antibody in the investigational arms, or at least of this size. Unsurprisingly, at least the data we have so far, is that the PFS is going to be improved with both AV and AVO. I think this surprises nobody that these are better than chemoimmunotherapy. And you can see the chemoimmunotherapy had a median PFS reached, but neither investigational arm with AV or AVO had a median reached, which is important. And you might see maybe better disease control with the addition of Obin if you look at the estimated 36-month PFS there, but you do actually see, looks like numerically more deaths with the addition of obinutuzumab and COVID-19-related deaths. So I am interested with additional follow-up if we see that we do get better disease control, but also greater toxicity, kind of how this plays out. So I encourage everyone to attend that session Monday and really see the full results of this study. So I'm looking forward to seeing that myself. So that's ibrutinib and acalabrutinib, but zanubrutinib was not left out of the party. So this is zanubrutinib and venetoclax. This is the Sequoia study that Jeff was showing you, comparing zanu to BR. That study actually took patients with deletion 17 PCLL out of the randomization and put them in a separate arm. And in one cohort, they studied zanubrutinib and venetoclax with, it looks like, very good responses. And I would love to see longer follow-up from this, but it was tolerable with a very high response rate in this high-risk population. And then actually in relapse refractory CLL, I think this very kind of novel study, which is not a phase three, but is looking at the zanubrutinib venetoclax combination in cohorts of previously treated CLL patients, those that never had a targeted agent, those that had them but were not resistant to them, and then those whose CLLs become resistant to covalent BTK inhibitors. And Dr. Ahn's going to present more follow-up from this study at this meeting on Saturday. So I think this will be really interesting in the relapse refractory setting to look at how these different populations of previously treated CLL patients benefit. There's, of course, a three drug with ZVO, the Bovin study, which has very good response rates. You can see the diagram on there. It had like an MRD kind of guided discontinuation. And there'll be an update on this study at this meeting, which I look forward to seeing. And then just to finish up with something that I think is really important is so far when we've been talking about BCL2 inhibitors, we've been talking about venetoclax, because that's the currently approved BCL2 inhibitor. But it's not the only one that's really making it into larger studies now. So we are seeing newer BCL2 inhibitors in development now making it to the clinic with substantial data. And this is sonrotoclax, which is a potent and selective BCL2 inhibitor. The kind of difference between that and venetoclax are activity against BCL-xL, which is another anti-apoptotic protein, and also it works in the setting of a known venetoclax resistance mutation, the G101V. There is a phase 1-1B study of this combination that there, again, will be an update at this meeting. I'm trying to make sure everyone here comes to all the CLL sessions because I think it's going to be an exciting year for us. This combination, of course, very effective, so very high rates of complete remission, response rates, and undetectable MRD. The dose selected for additional study is going to be the 320 if you look at the really nice response rates there and a reasonable safety profile. So these are ongoing phase 3 studies with these combinations that we don't have data from yet. So you can see these are still under active investigation, and I think additional follow-up on studies is going to be key, but we still have some that we don't have data from. That one that's EA9161 is similar to that one I was talking about that's IO versus IVO, but this is in younger patients. We have Celestial on there, and that's going to be the zanubrutinib sonrotoclax compared to venetoclax obinutuzumab, and a bunch of others that are really going to add to what we know. The two in gray are studies in previously treated CLL with actually non-covalent BTK inhibitors. So I think it's going to be a really exciting time to see some of this data.
Thank you, Carrie. That was great. I totally appreciate that. Well, we have a number of questions from the group, as well as some that we had ready to go. I'm going to start with Farouk. Amplify is the big study this year, right? This is the big frontline study, and BTK BCL2 combos. It's kind of tortured, right? Because it's approved in the European theater, but not in the U.S. based on GLOW. So I think a lot of folks are anticipating that. AV or possibly even AVO could become a treatment option for us. And so, we haven't seen the data. I recognize there's all sorts of limitations. But as you're thinking about acalabrutinib venetoclax as a treatment option, where, even without the data, because it's coming up, how do you think about incorporating that regimen into your practice?
So I'm personally very excited about that combination. And I think from work that Bill's group has reported in the other concern that I had was that if you are using a time-limited option, like Kerry said, what's the long-term outcome of that patient? What's going to happen when the disease does relapse 5, 6, 7 years down the road? How will you salvage those patients? And I think it's encouraging that with a time-limited AV or IV approach that we have data on, that we don't see those resistance mutations emerging. So I think that's very provocative. That's very interesting. So the argument is that you can reuse this potentially in the future with similar, hopefully, results, so you don't jeopardize the length of time that the patient would be in remission and their overall survivals. I don't personally am a fan of the triplet therapy. I understand that we have access to CD20 antibody, but I think the more data is coming out, the more I'm leaning against using a triplet and more sticking to the doublet. The big question in the field is whether AV or IV or whatever, ZV, is that better than Ven-Obin? I think that would be the eventual argument, and I know that multiple efforts are underway to address that question. So personally, I would love to address that question. I'm very excited about using the doublet as an option for time-limited therapy for patients with previously untreated disease. I have done that off trial in my personal experience. The other big question that has happened, which actually happened last week, and we have a shared a patient that we shared with other colleagues in the room, and the argument was that person has TP53 disease and have finished therapy with acalabrutinib and venetoclax. She's in MRD6 negative remission. Do you stop the acalabrutinib? And the answer is, we don't know. But because of the high-risk disease, I think the decision was made to continue the BTK inhibitor. Is that the right approach? I don't know the answer to that. I think there's disagreement. But, you know, this is an evolving field. This is exactly why we need to put patients on a clinical trial.
Right. You had a lot in your response, a lot of threads we can keep pulling on. And Beetz, I'll come to you next. But I'm thinking about, you know, I'm envisioning, who knows, but we get a label for AV, and that's speculative, of course. But how would you pick between acalaven versus obinutuzumab ven they're two doublets, right? So if we're moving into a doublet world, how do you pick between that, or what sort of thoughts go through your mind?
Yeah, so the CLL14 trial had 60% patients with unmutated IGHV, and if you look at that subset analysis, the median PFS for unmutated IGHV was 65 months. So I tried to translate this for my patients. This means that you take the combination for a year, you enjoy a four-year progression-free survival, and then your disease comes back. To me, that's acceptable, as long as it is also acceptable to a patient. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the combination of AV, yes, you can consider that for unmutated IGHV. Of course, we need data to be totally convinced it is meaningfully better for unmutated IGHV patients. I think the OV data is good enough, unless we see, you know, in the trials that, you know, we mentioned, particularly the Celestial trial, which is combining zanubrutinib plus sonrotoclax versus OV. I think that's a trial that is going to answer that question adequately. But I think OV is good enough for IGHV unmutated patient. But if someone has TP53 aberrant disease, I think I'm more inclined toward using a BTK inhibitor with venetoclax.
Yeah. Yeah. Bill, I'm going to ask you a challenging question. Are singlets dead?
Are singlets dead? No, I think there are appropriate patients for singlet therapy. Venetoclax single agent, I'm not inclined to use. I'm inclined to optimize venetoclax-based therapy by adding a CD20 antibody or BTK inhibitor. So we're talking about singlets in regard to the BTK inhibitors, and as we talked about, that first patient we talked about is an appropriate patient for single agent BTK inhibitor based therapy. So I don't think they're dead. There will be specific patients that we identify that are most appropriate for that strategy.
Well, so Carrie, the follow-on question is, Bill says singlets aren't dead, and I think I agree with him. I'm sure, I suspect most of us think there'll be a role for BTK monotherapy. But the flip side of that quarter is, are we at a place where triplets are usable now?
Oh, I think that's an excellent question. I mean, the data with I plus B, which is, you know, the longest one we have of a BTK inhibitor, BCL2 inhibitor combination, I think is pretty compelling. And if AV gets approved, I think people start using it. If you look at the triplet data, I mean, we have experience with it at Ohio State with the data I was showing you from the IBO study. The patients who enrolled in that study were mostly younger and fitter, not because of the eligibility criteria, just based on who chose to enroll, and most found it quite tolerable. But I do think more drugs always means more side effects, and when you look at the limited data we've seen so far, I mean, we'll get a better picture later in the meeting from Amplify, it looks like, you know, deaths are higher with that, you know, toxicity is going to be higher with more drugs. And so even if we see a progression-free survival benefit with the three-drug combination, you're going to have to really think seriously about whether it's worth the toxicity. So I think that triplets, until there's more data, are not currently something I would prescribe outside of a clinical trial. But it is likely that for younger, fitter patients where you're less concerned about some of these toxicities, they might be appropriate if there is a disease control benefit. But I think, you know, you have to think carefully about that. And the original point about is monotherapy dead? Absolutely not with BTK inhibitors. And I completely agree with Bill about the older patient with high-risk disease. More drugs is always more side effects, and you know, monotherapy is appropriate, especially for less fit patients. And if you have an older person, they might only need one treatment in their lifespan. And so doing something like a doublet or a triplet is probably not going to help them much there.
All right, show of hands from the panel here. Question is, agree or disagree? Well, raise your hand if you agree. Outside of a clinical trial, Amplify data notwithstanding, because we haven't seen it yet, but outside of a clinical trial, triplets do not yet are not yet a routine part of my practice. Agree?
Agree.
Okay. Yeah, I think we have consensus there. Great. Well, I'm going to, Farouk, you'd had a comment, and I'm actually going to pass this on to Bita, because I know it dovetails with some of what she's going to talk about. It's actually on this next slide. You know, resistance mutations is this kind of new topic. We really haven't brought it up just yet. But maybe if you could talk about BTK resistance mutations, what they look like, how we see them, when they show up, if frontline therapy affects that, just sort of general comments.
Sure. Because our audience are our community colleagues, someone said something really profound to me. Let's not say more than we know. And I really want to emphasize that the mutational evolution and profile with covalent and non-covalent BTK inhibitors is an area that the field is still learning. But we know that the most common resistance mutation with covalent BTK inhibitors is CIS481, and there are others such as PLC-gamma2. But when you have a patient on a covalent BTK inhibitor in the frontline or relapse refractory setting, so a patient, enjoys some time on the drug, a prolonged time on the drug, and then for other reasons, for clinical reasons, you have clinical suspicion that this patient is progressing. And then, in all those cases that someone on a covalent BTK inhibitor progresses, I check the acquired BTK inhibitor resistance mutation panel, which basically checks for CIS481 and PLC-gamma2. If it comes back positive, it's kind of reassuring, but there are a good number, 40% of those patients basically develop CIS481S mutation, but there are a large number of patients who you are convinced they're progressing on their covalent BTK inhibitor, but they haven't developed any of the resistance mutations. I think it is definitely of value to check, but with the knowledge that not always lack of these mutations does not necessarily translate into lack of resistance to a BTK inhibitor, because those two mutations are a tip of an iceberg. Now we are learning that there are so many other mutations that are involved.
Thanks. Farouk, a lot of these studies report out MRD, and I think MRD is this whole large area where people just, how to use this routinely is hard. I'm going to ask you kind of a first half of the question. I'm going to ask Bill the second half of the question, but MRD, molecular or flow, how do you use it?
Both. I am spoiled, so I am giving you my thought. It took us a while to set up an in-house flow-based MRD so we can do up to 4.5 MRD testing in-house, so I have easy access to that. For feel-good purposes, if patients insist, if some of the more educated, informed patients would want their MRD 6 levels through clonoSEQ, so that's what I do. How does it influence my practice? That's a bigger question. It really doesn't right now. If I'm starting with the thought process that I'm going to stop treatment after 12 months, I'm going to stop treatment after 12 months, regardless of the MRD. If I am to continue therapy, then MRD doesn't matter. Does it make me feel better? Sure. If I get into an MRD 3, I have a patient recently that we started on a clinical trial, then the clinical trial doesn't demand MRD testing. The patient said, oh, what's my MRD level? Because my counts are normal in 3 months. I checked his MRD. In 3 months, he's MRD 6 negative. Beautiful response. Yeah. So I think it's good for the patients. It's good to know. Does it impact my practice at this point? The answer is no. It's reassuring, obviously, that the deeper the MRD, the longer the remission. I think that makes sense in most cases, and that could be potentially used as a tool to guide treatment in the future. But right now, I don't use it routinely. And then also, we have to understand that your regular flow is not the MRD flow. Just for the audience, please, it's a very, very insensitive assay that we use for diagnostic purposes. The flow MRD is available in limited places in the US. In some places, you have to ask for a specific flow MRD, and the only other MRD is the clonoSEQ MRD option that I'm aware of. There may be others, but that also requires a baseline sample. So if you don't have a bone marrow, if you don't have a lymph node at baseline, it's hard to get a baseline clone to track the MRD in the future. So that does become an issue if you don't have a baseline sample for that.
Super. Well, we got you warmed up here. We're going to let you go ahead and take on Module 3, the optimal management of adverse events with BTK and BCL2 inhibitors. Take it away.
Thanks, Jeff. And I'm old enough to trained in an era where the only option we had was FR and FCR. We were fighting about that all the time. So when we saw hypertension, oh, that's not even a real side effect. So I'm coming from that mindset. So you know, we're all spoiled. It's great for our patients, but we don't have to deal with the badness that we saw with chemotherapy. And then I remember having a conversation during my training and then early on as a faculty member about the use of CFAR and OFAR that were very active treatments for certain patients with CLL and Richter's. And, you know, we were ready to manage the toxicities, and it wasn't that big a deal. Bring it on. So, you know, our mindset has changed, and we're arguing about small little things, but this is what's important now. We have access to really, really good treatments, and that's why we've evolved. I think it's great news for our patients. Another caveat is I had, you know, how patients perceive side effects. So we had a clinical trial for a patient with untreated disease. He lives a couple of hours away from Dallas, and I said, hey, you don't have to come. This is your platelet counts are dropping. You need therapy. Your hemoglobin is also dropping. So his platelets were in the 80,000 range. So he'll probably need treatment in the next few weeks or so. It's slowly going down. I've been keeping an eye on this guy for a while. And he was like, doc, can I skip a visit? I was like, sure, just get labs done locally. So, and he was like, what's my option? So I said, you know, hey, this is a standard of care clinical trial. I'm not going to name the clinical trial, but it's basically all the drugs in the clinical trial are approved. These are approved, FDA-approved drugs. We use it all the time, except it's two different arms being compared. Very simple, no-brainer clinical trial. And he said, why don't you send me some reading material? I'll read on it, and then I'll get back to you. I sent him the consent form. I was like, sure, take a look, and then we'll talk, and then we'll go from there. And he's like, after reading this, I don't want to do the trial. And I was expecting that. It's so toxic. Why can't I just get platelets? And I explained why he didn't. And then he finally came around. He understood. So I think it's always scary when you read about it. But the point I would like to make is these drugs have revolutionized cares for our patients. They're generally very well tolerated. And we're frankly nitpicking for the next 10 minutes or so on which one is safer than the other. And as Jeff said, there are no head-to-head comparisons, and they're only a match-adjusted analysis, or makes, or mics, or whatever you want to call it. Maybe we should propose doing a make for makes and see what the end outcomes is for all of those makes. Because there is no data head-to-head to compare it, except for the newer BTK inhibitors, the first generation, 3 BTK inhibitors with ibrutinib. So that's all we have, and that's what I'll share with you, and then happy to take any questions later on. So basically, what are we looking at other than the usual cytopenias, which we see in every trial with CLL, because that's the nature of our disease? We will see the thrombocytopenias, we will see the neutropenias, we will see the anemias, obviously. The other unique side effects are bleeding issues, cardiovascular toxicities. A point I would like to make here is we tend to lump cardiovascular toxicities into one, which is an absolute wrong thing to do. I think we have to delineate it into atrial fibrillation and hypertension. This is not hypertension causing atrial fibrillation 10 years down the road, which is what happens in normal people without these medicines. You know, as we get older, we get AFib because we've had uncontrolled hypertension for 20 years. This is completely different. AFib happens right away. Within the first few months, hypertension happens right away. So these are mechanistically, physiologically slightly different. Obviously, they are interconnected. But it's not that hypertension would eventually cause atrial fibrillation because of cardiac remodeling business. So slightly different problems. Atrial fibrillation is one. Hypertension is another. Possibly ventricular arrhythmias is another one. And we can talk about it if you have time. And then obviously infectious complications. COVID is here to stay. How do we mitigate that? How do we minimize that risk? We don't have a strategy yet. It's an evolving science at this point. So why did we stop using ibrutinib? And this is from the Alliance studies that we've shown the data earlier. Very effective treatment. Nothing wrong with ibrutinib, except, like I said, we are nitpicking. So what do we nitpick on? And the biggest thing is deaths. Sudden cardiac deaths is a big deal. And this is one of the reasons that, especially in older folks, ibrutinib did result in a higher risk of cardiac side effects and sudden cardiac deaths, which is one of the reasons that led to the unfavorable use or lack of use of fibrutinib and then our shifting to the newer BTK inhibitors. So that was kind of the start of the process, and obviously as the new drugs became available, we had data from the ELEVATE study, which was acalabrutinib in the frontline setting, and, you know, looked pretty decent here. And then zanubrutinib was also the same. Again, bleeding does seem to be a class effect. I think all BTK inhibitors will cause bleeding, even the newer ones, even the second generation ones. We just don't have enough data on the non-covalent ones yet, but I suspect that that would also cause BTK inhibitor-related bleeding issues. Kerry can probably talk about that some more, but in my opinion, bleeding is a side effect of the BTK class, so you can never probably get away from it, maybe in the future. This is what I was talking about with pirtobrutinib. You still see a fair amount of bleeding and bruising, so it's not that bad. It's manageable. You know, you can handle it. So, but again, like I said, small little points. What can we look at? One thing we do realize that the risk of atrial fibrillation, which used to be pretty substantial with ibrutinib, has come down with zanubrutinib and acalabrutinib, and now with pirtobrutinib and nemtabrutinib, which is the other non-covalent BTK inhibitor. All right, so moving on to, this is the nemtabrutinib study. Again, limited data. We still have smaller number of patients. We still see hypertension is background noise because our patients are older. We have more data we need more data to look at this. COVID will stay with us. Atrial fibrillation, also possibly background noise with nemtabrutinib. So, you know, this is evolving. We just need more data with pirto and nemta before we make any judgments on these side effects. All right, so let's compare ibrutinib with acalabrutinib, ibrutinib versus zanubrutinib, because, you know, the answer is which one do we pick? So atrial fibrillation was less in patients who were treated with acalabrutinib versus ibrutinib in a head-to-head comparison. So that was one of the reasons for not using ibrutinib, along with the other side effects. Acalabrutinib, on the other hand, has headaches, which are typically very responsive to caffeine treatment, so coffee works very nicely. Or caffeine tablets work very nicely for most patients. So atrial fibrillation was less, bleeding was less, hypertension was less, and so on. And I'll show you graphs, which makes more sense. Similarly, when you compare zanubrutinib versus ibrutinib, you do see that the risk of atrial fibrillation with zanubrutinib was less as compared to ibrutinib, substantially bleeding. Seem to be fairly similar, though, and hypertension potentially slightly worse or almost the same. So then which one is better? This is why if you lump cardiovascular toxicities, you don't get the accurate picture. So just to make it simple, for people who wanted seen, and again, we should not be doing cross-trial comparison, but you know what, we can do it. We'll use our academic license to do it. This is kind of how it looks. If you look at the blue in acalabrutinib, it appears to be better in terms of bleeding, hypertension, and AFib. And on the flip side, you have the alpine, which is basically hypertension, almost the same, bleeding, almost the same, atrial fibrillation, definitely better. So that's just one way. And if you're not a figures person, I put it like this. I put the numbers on, so you can look at the numbers. So which one is better? You make your decision. So again, like I said, this is not the best way to compare those. There's multiple issues, patient selection, era. Ibrutinib Resonate 2 is significantly better from all the ibrutinib that's happening right now by almost a year. Why did that happen? Why doesn't ibrutinib work? Nothing's happened to ibrutinib. It's our perception of toxicities, and we're spoiled for choice. We don't want to deal with the side effects. We recognize side effects earlier, and we're biased against ibrutinib. So is ibrutinib even a relevant comparator in the next generation of clinical trials? And the answer is not. Unfortunately, that's the path that a lot of clinical trials will take and keep comparing to chlorambucil in the past, and now ibrutinib is the next one. So unfortunately, this is the phase that happens in clinical development. Anyway, how do you manage a patient with these issues? So basically, if there's a high-risk cardiovascular risk patient, you do the baseline cardiovascular assessment, get a cardio-oncologist involved if it's a high-risk person, And then you manage, co-manage, and then keep an eye on those things. And if they need EKGs, echocardiograms, that's fine. But you have to be aware, you have to manage it very aggressively. You stop the ibrutinib for 3 days before a minor procedure, 7 days before a major procedure, and hopefully avoid a lot of the bleeding issues. Antiplatelet therapy is worse than anticoagulants generally. So if the aspirin and Plavix are a bigger issue, then apixaban or endoxaban and so on. So can you manage atrial fibrillation? Absolutely. You can dose adjust. You can do beta blockers and go from there. Hypertension, similarly, can be managed. So that's kind of what it is. And then neutropenia is another thing that you see mostly with zanubrutinib and ibrutinib, but you also see with all of these drugs. So growth factors can be done to ensure dose density. And finally, very quickly, I'll go through the BCL2 antagonists. And I'll just talk about...
Sure. No, I just in the interest of time, keep it up. I appreciate the discussion, but want to make sure we have enough time for some of the questions from the audience. Thank you, Farouk. Bill, I'll start with you with regards to hypertension. A patient comes in with a history of hypertension. Does that influence your BTK selection?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think it's most important to make sure that they're connected with their cardiologist, if they have a cardiologist, that their blood pressure is well managed before putting them on the BTK inhibitor. It would be a second-generation BTK inhibitor. Just have a discussion with them about anticipating the possibility of that becoming worse on a BTK inhibitor and that they need to keep close tabs on their blood pressure and follow up with their cardiologist.
And Bita, to you, somebody who comes in already with pre-existing three-drug hypertension, does the rates of hypertension difference between Zanu and Acala influence you if somebody's got sort of refractory hypertension?
Slightly, yes. So from at least the Alpine trial comparing Zanu to ibrutinib, we know that they're both associated with hypertension, which is a late toxicity, and the cumulative incidence of hypertension increases with time, so it doesn't plateau. And, you know, I hate for a patient who's going to be on indefinite therapy, develop a side effect, adding three more medicines to manage that side effect. So the polypharmacy associated with that is not acceptable in this time and age. So in patients with very hard to control hypertension requiring more antihypertensive therapies, I'm slightly inclined toward using acalabrutinib.
You know, I probably too much information, but I'm running this one clinical trial right now, and patients with three-drug hypertension are excluded from receiving ibrutinib on the study. I'm like, I wouldn't qualify, you know. So it is an issue that can come up for folks with regards to the hypertension. Carrie, with the headaches, when you're starting acalabrutinib, how do you talk to somebody about headache? Do you preempt it, or do you how do you navigate that before they start acalabrutinib?
Yeah, so I usually, when I describe side effects in general, I talk about hypertension, AFib, as like side effects that doctors worry about people getting a lot that we look for. But then there's like the side effects that are bothersome to patients, which you were kind of saying earlier, that they live with every day. And while not medically serious, so I'm not as worried about it, they have to live with this, and that's really important. And I put headaches in that category that most of the time, there's something patients experience that aren't medically serious but can impact like how they feel taking the drugs. I usually make sure I tell people that this can happen and that usually it doesn't last forever, so it can go away after weeks or months of taking acalabrutinib, and that's generally the case. I've also seen a lot of the headaches are not that bothersome to people. They'll notice them, but then I'm like, oh, did you take, you know, acetaminophen for this? And they're like, oh, no, by the time I thought to get the acetaminophen, the headache was better. Or like, no, I just drink coffee. I mean, caffeine works usually for a lot of patients. And so I do let them know that for a majority of patients, these aren't something that's really impairing their day-to-day, you know, indefinitely on this drug or long-term. And then usually we have some suggestions like caffeine, and actually the APPs I work with that talk to the patients a lot about this started recommending Excedrin no aspirin because it's got like caffeine in it, and that seems to be great. So lots of patients will try that, so sometimes we'll suggest that or acetaminophen as well. But I definitely go over this as a side effect, set the expectation that in the minority of cases it's really problematic, but most of the time it's not, and then have a couple solutions and remind them that they can call us for advice if they experience this and it's bothersome.
Super. Beta, I'll come to you with this case that was presented here, which is renal insufficiency, which I think gives us some pause when we think about venetoclax. You know, in a patient that you feel like you need to treat with venetoclax who's got renal insufficiency, how do you approach their case differently or uniquely?
Yes, so I want to remind everyone that the CLL14 trial was really did not cherry pick. So it included patients with basically creatinine clearance of less than 70, and the median creatinine clearance on the CLL14 trial was 62. So it's not like patients with great kidneys were enrolled on the trial. And I think the way we are administering the OV regimen in the frontline setting, you know, with basically three doses of obinutuzumab, when you get to day 22 of venetoclax, you have debulked the disease well enough to significantly reduce the risk of tumor lysis syndrome. So I personally believe the risk of tumor lysis syndrome with venetoclax has been blown out of proportion. And data speaks, if you go to the CLL14 trial, check me on the exact numbers, but I think out of 216 patients on the OV, basically, arm, only three patients, 1%, developed lab TLS, and they didn't even meet the clinical criteria for TLS. So, yes, I pause if someone does not have the best kidneys, but I think data is reassuring, you know, and we have the luxury of having a lot of nurses. It takes a village to give OV, but encouraging hydration, giving IV fluids, and honestly, the majority of tumor lysis syndrome happens with the three first doses of obinutuzumab, and by the time that patients get to day 22, because of the fact that their disease has been debulked, I worry less about TLS risk. And the venetoclax ramp-up is so gradual over 5 weeks that is an added layer of reassurance.
Bill, I come to you for this one, but I think that we've built up this narrative about TLS from venetoclax, but obinutuzumab is not a completely benign drug with TLS, and I think rates are sort of 7 to 10% or so. Do you do anything when you're starting your obinutuzumab patients, you know, checking for TLS? Do you do it in certain patients or all patients, or how do you manage that?
The highest risk are for patients who have high white counts, obviously. So I'll make sure that they're on allopurinol. I will check for, you know, the first cycle is the 100 milligrams on day one, 900 milligrams on day two. So I do check labs during that time, and we'll check labs even after the 900 milligram dose and the following week. So that's the period we have, can have some challenges. So making sure they're on allopurinol, making sure they get IV hydration if I think they need it, if they have a high white count, taking into consideration their kidney function is very important. So as you say, the risk is probably higher now with obinutuzumab than it is with our standard ramp up with venetoclax. So yeah, we have to be careful of that.
And Carrie, you know, the prescribing information for venetoclax does have kind of a modification of risk stratification with renal insufficiency and so forth. So, you know, is the Ohio State admitting patients for patients with high-risk disease or who have renal insufficiency, or how do you make that decision about who you admit, or are you doing it entirely in the outpatient setting?
Yeah, so when I use venetoclax, not as part of a clinical trial, because of course they have separate criteria for what you do, I actually try to follow the full prescribing information on how to give the venetoclax in terms of who gets admitted and who doesn't. And so there's low, medium, and high risk for TLS. And if people are still at high risk, I do admit them for monitoring. And then in the medium risk, if their kidney function is decreased to the point where it's recommended based on the full prescribing, I do admit them for monitoring. So there's plenty of patients that are able to be treated entirely outpatient based on disease burden. But if I'm giving it as standard of care, I do follow the prescribing information. There's an opportunity, though, especially if someone, if you've done CTs and, of course, at the lymphocyte count at baseline, the TLS risk is mostly based on the absolute lymphocyte count and lymph nodes. So if I see the lymph nodes aren't that big, and then after the obin, the lymphocyte count comes down to the point where they're no longer high risk, there's an opportunity to reassess after the obin to see if you can keep people from being admitted for this, that the disease is decreased to the point where it's unnecessary. So I do pay close attention to that and hope to treat most patients as an outpatient.
Great. Farouk, I recently had two patients I've managed recently. One who has Osler-Weber-Rendu syndrome, and just like a hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasias in the nose, and she has actually developed iron deficiency from nosebleeds before, and another patient with pretty significant von Willebrand's disease, where you know after reading the risks and benefits of BTK, even though he had sort of high risk disease, he's like, I want OB-Ven. So, how do you manage bleeding side effects when they come up, and what are the sort of circumstances where that influences your care?
So we did a lot of these things, and we've learned it the hard way. We actually have treated patients with von Willebrand disease with acalabrutinib in the past, when we didn't realize how bad things were, and obviously we found out that that increases the risk of bleeding, so we didn't do it after that. So I think if it's this very unique situation where there's a very super high risk or some sort of underlying bleeding diathesis, and especially if it's related to von Willebrand disease or something similar, I would most likely sway away from the use of BTK inhibitors generally if that's significant and life-threatening. A lot of times patients are on fish oil and supplements, which we don't talk about. So it's important to have the pharmacist involved to look at interactions. They could be on other azoles, which can substantially increase the dose of the BTK inhibitors by a certain times, not percent, but multiple times, 23 times with azoles, for example, with the ibrutinib. So, those are minor things that we tend to ignore. And at least from our earlier experience with the use of BTK inhibitors in the first 571 patients, we did see that the vast majority of patients who had a bleeding risk was with antiplatelet therapy rather than with anticoagulation. So that's actually a bigger risk. So somebody's had an MI and they need a double dual antiplatelet for 6 months. That would be a tricky patient to manage. Can you manage them? Sure. But then the risk of bleeding would be substantially high. I had recently had a patient with a mechanical heart valve. They have to be on Coumadin. Same argument, we used venetoclax in that person because of the fact that I wasn't comfortable managing the risk with Coumadin-related toxicity. If there's a persistent nosebleed, I think if it's a localized issue, you can probably look at ENT and ablation and see if that helps. But I think it's a lot of these other factors that make it harder to manage.
Excellent. All right, well, Bita, we got you here to talk about integration of the non-covalent. These are coming on strong here. We'll get to hear more about them at ASH. Look forward to your slides. Go for it.
Great. So you heard a lot about covalent BTK inhibitors and BCL2 inhibitors, and you saw in Jeff's slide that ibrutinib got approved for patients with relapsed refractory CLL in February 2014, so 11 years into this truly revolutionary phase in the field of CLL. Now there is a term emerging more and more, and that's called double-exposed, double-refractory CLL. And those are patients who have been exposed and either refractory to or intolerant to both classes of covalent BTK inhibitors and BCL2 inhibitors. And that's going to be the new focus in the next decade, because now that our patients with CLL have enjoyed prolonged progression-free survivals from the availability of these agents, when they become refractory to these new novel targets and or intolerant, what's next for them? So how I make a decision, you know, the three major basically components in making decisions, patient-specific factors, age, comorbidities, and, you know, we are living in an era that fortunately patients with CLL have a menu of options available to them, so personal preferences definitely plays a role. And there are disease-specific factors, particularly TP53 aberrant disease, either deletion 17P and or TP53 mutation. I think we spoke enough about IGHV mutation status, whether we are dealing with bulky disease or not, and also therapeutic-specific factors. We learned about the side effect profile of covalent BTK inhibitors in addition to BCL2 inhibitors, and also route of administration, IV versus PO. So if I can do one thing right today, is to make sure that we all totally understand the difference between covalent or irreversible and non-covalent or reversible BTK inhibitors. So currently, there are three FDA-approved covalent BTK inhibitors approved, ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, and zanubrutinib. And here you see the kinome map. Each circle represents basically a target inhibition, and the radius of the circle represents the basically affinity for that target. So here you see that ibrutinib has the highest off-target inhibition as compared to acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib. Both of the molecules have a cleaner kinome map, and it clinically also translated to a better side effect profile, as you heard in the previous talks. So covalent BTK inhibitors, all three molecules require to make a covalent bond with the C481S site of the BTK enzyme. So if a mutation happens, none of these molecules are going to be able to sit tightly on the target, and as a result, they're not going to be able to exert their function. And that's when non-covalent BTK inhibitors come into play. The two that are currently available, pirtobrutinib and nemtabrutinib, with pirtobrutinib being the only and the first FDA-approved one. So if a patient develops CIS481 mutation, non-covalent BTK inhibitors, they're more liberal in their action. They don't require that strict shape of the receptor. They bind, unbind, rebind. And as a result, they're a very reasonable option in patients who have become resistant to covalent BTK inhibitors, particularly with C481S mutation. So talking about pirtobrutinib is a highly selective BTK inhibitor. And if you look at the steady state plasma exposure, it corresponds to 96% of BTK target inhibition with a half-life of slightly less than a day, 20 hours. And here you see that in contrast to covalent BTK inhibitors, it appears to stabilize BTK in a closed and inactive conformation, and as such, it blocks access to upstream kinase and phosphorylations, and it inhibits scaffolding interaction that support kinase-independent BTK signaling. So the trial that resulted in the approval of pirtobrutinib almost a year ago is a phase 1-2 Bruin study, phase 1 dose escalation, dose expansion, and the drug was given in 25 to 300 milligrams daily dosing, and the recommended phase 2 dose was 200 milligrams daily. And if you look at the eligibility criteria, so each cycle was 28 days, and cohort expansion was permitted, and in terms of eligibility, adult patients with good performance status, meeting criteria based on IWCLL, and the key endpoints like any phase 1 and phase 2, safety, tolerability, in addition to some efficacy endpoints, particularly overall response rate. So to simplify this, Bruin had multiple cohorts. The one that I'm focused on is the CLL cohort, and here you see that the specific sub-cohort is the one with prior covalent BTK inhibitor exposed patients, which were 282 patients. And again, so one of the sub-cohorts was patients without previous exposure to venetoclax, and the other one, the so-called double refractory patients. So I do want to spend some time and highlight the patient characteristics. So if you look at the basically characteristics, the majority of patients had high stage disease with good performance status. With a median, I'm focusing on double exposed, double refractory on the far right, with a median 5 prior lines of therapy ranging from 1 to 11. So a truly heavily pretreated patient population. All patients based on definition had to receive a previous covalent BTK inhibitor and a BCL2 inhibitor. About 90% of patients had exposure to chemoimmunotherapy, FCR, or BR. About 4 out of 10 patients had seen a previous PI3 kinase inhibitor. Importantly, 15 patients had seen a CAR-T product, and 6 patients had allogeneic stem cell transplantation. So this is not necessarily representative of the contemporary patient population that we see in CLL who have started their CLL journey with oral therapies. This is a very heavily pretreated patient population. And if you look at the reason for BTK discontinuation, 84% due to disease progression and 16% due to intolerance. And here you see that patients are enriched in high-risk features, particularly 17p deletion and or TP53 mutation. And almost 95% of patients had unmutated IGHV, and half of the patients had a complex karyotype defined as 3 or more chromosome abnormalities. So in this heavily pretreated patient population, the overall response rate was was 82%, with the majority of responses being PR at 70%. And if you separate based on patients who had not seen venetoclax and had only been exposed to a covalent BTK inhibitor as compared to double exposed or double refractory patients, you see that the overall response rate doesn't differ that much, with 83% in patients who had not seen a previous BCL2 inhibitor as compared to 80% in double exposed, double refractory patients. And here you see that the response is independent of CIS481S mutation, complex karyotype, and also deletion 17P and or TP53 mutation. I do basically bring it to your attention that patients with PCL2 or PLC gamma 2 mutation, they were borderline, so they did not respond as well as patients who lacked PCL2 gamma mutation. And if you look at the median progression-free survival, at a median follow-up of 28 months for all comers, the median progression-free survival was 19.4 months. And if you look at the double-exposed patient population, the median progression-free survival was 16 months. So this is a patient population heavily pretreated, enriched in high-risk features. They enjoyed about 1.5 years of progression-free survival. And we talked about toxicities, a truly well-tolerated molecule with fatigue, neutropenia, diarrhea, and contusion being the most common side effects. And I do want to bring it to your attention that the trial enrolled at the peak of COVID-19 infection. Here you see atrial fibrillation, grade 3 happened 1.8%, and hypertension 4.3%. 11 patients out of all the patients with CLL-282 required dose reduction, lower than 200 milligrams daily, and 7 patients discontinued treatment. And based on the data that I presented, pirtobrutinib on December 1st, 2023, got the accelerated approval for the double-exposed, double-refractory patient population, adding a new treatment option for the patients in this category. And a few words on the other, basically, and before we move here, you see that the basically pirtobrutinib phase 3 trials. I want to mention that BRUIN 321 is going to be presented, which is pirtobrutinib versus investigator choice of idelalisib rituximab, or BR, in the relapse refractory setting. By Dr. Sherman, here is the information. And nemtabrutinib is another non-covalent BTK inhibitor, which is being investigated at the dose of 65 milligrams daily, slightly less tolerated than pirtobrutinib. And here you see that the overall response rate with nemtabrutinib is about 60%, which is, again, another non-covalent BTK inhibitor for our patients. So to conclude my talk, in the third relapse setting for patients who have been exposed and failed both covalent BTK inhibitors and BCL2 inhibitors, we have two FDA-approved options, non-covalent BTK inhibitor, pirtobrutinib, and also the next talk, CD19 CAR-T therapy, which is great. But this area is becoming more and more crowded. Now we know that BTK degraders are in clinical trials, and we are going to hear some very good abstracts, some very good presentations. Bispecific T-cell engagers, epcoritamab results are going to be presented, and also allogeneic CAR-T therapy is another area of investigation, which opens and expands the armamentarium of treatment options for our patients with CLL. And with that being said, I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Gita. Carrie, the population of patients who are double refractory, in my own practice, I'm in a community setting, we don't see them as frequent. I think they're more commonly seen in academic practices, but they're starting to show up. I think community docs are starting to see these double refractory patients like, oh my God, what do I do? Do I go to chemotherapy? What's my choice? So how does age and sort of functional status, this is sort of reflective of the first question here, how do you determine where you're going after somebody's got those two drugs?
Yeah, I think we actually had a nice honeymoon period when we got these targeted agents where we had both BTK inhibitors and then the BCL2 inhibitor venetoclax, and now we are definitely seeing people whose CLL is resistant to both. And I think you're right, these patients are frequently either had been treated in an academic center and got targeted agents earlier in study or were referred because it's difficult to know what to do. The two options that have efficacy that have accelerated approval are pirtobrutinib, which we just heard a lot about, and then CAR T cell therapy. I think that pirtobrutinib is exceptionally easy to use. So you can give people the drug. Most of them tolerated a BTK inhibitor. So patients are like, cool, it's like a more tolerable version of the ibrutinib I got, you know, before I got venetoclax. And, you know, it's easy to start and take, but I always set the expectation with people that the amount of time it works for is about a year and a half in this setting. If you have someone who's 80, you know, their life expectancy still might be more than a year and a half, and so they're going to be in a difficult spot after the pirtobrutinib. So while it's easy to do now, it's certainly not a long-term solution. And these are definitely the patients where participation in a clinical trial, if they're able with something like a BTK degrader or novel agents, could have more benefit than even the options with accelerated approval. For younger patients, I think this would be a time when CAR T cell therapy should be strongly considered. I like to explain to patients that only about 1 out of 5 people who undergo that therapy are going to get what we really want, which is long-term disease control for years. And, you know, that's not an awesome number. So, you know, 4 out of 5 would be better, and it's 1 out of 5. But this is a good opportunity to do that, because if you're in the group of patients that really gets a long-term response, you know, that's good, and really going into CAR T with less disease is going to make you more likely to have a good response. So even using pirtobrutinib as a way to get disease under control for CAR T would be important in younger patients. But again, this is the group of people where I would strongly encourage clinical trial participation for anyone who's able, because in both younger and older patients, these therapies, unless they get CAR T and end up in the very good response category, aren't going to be enough to get them through their natural lifespan, and investigational agents are something that would likely benefit them. Our institution does have experience combining covalent BTK inhibitor and venetoclax, ibrutinib venetoclax, in double refractory CLL. Oddly, that works, and we published a retrospective series on that, but there's not prospective data there, and relapses after that combination, if given to progression, are very difficult to control in terms of the disease. So this is still a very difficult population.
Great, thanks. Farouk, just general comments on tolerability of pirtobrutinib. Where does it stack amongst the other BTK inhibitors?
Very easy to tolerate. I think all the non-covalent BTK inhibitors, we haven't seen any unique specific side effects that I can remember. And, you know, we've talked about what's important for the patient and what's important for me. You know, that's different things. Do I see anything that's important for me? We do see the usual cytopenias with pirtobrutinib, which is what we expect with all patients with CLL, infectious issues. Do we see anything that the patient complains of? I really haven't had any issues. Once in a while, possibly some diarrhea. But otherwise, they're very, very well tolerated. The problem is we don't have any head-to-head comparison to make a categorical statement on that. So early results look very promising that they're well tolerated.
And Bita, any role for pirtobrutinib in the frontline setting? Any data to support that yet?
So there is a trial, phase 3 trial, pirto versus ibrutinib. 20% of that trial belong to the treatment naive cohort, and 80% relapse refractory. So let's see what the data is going to show.
Right. And Bill, do you have any concerns moving pirto in front of a covalent BTK inhibitor with regards to mechanism of resistance?
Yes, I do. We know for the covalent BTK inhibitors, the resistance-associated mutation is predominantly the C481 mutation. With pirto in the relapsed setting, we've looked at the mutation landscape among those patients. Many of them, all of them, had had a prior covalent BTK inhibitor, many of whom had a C481 mutation. On pirto, they lose their C481 mutation, but there are others that they acquire. But it's 40% of the patients who have a BTK mutation associated with pirto resistance. And so there's some mechanism and resistance mechanisms that are in play, I think, with pirto that we don't really understand. It's approved in the relapse setting. And so I think it should probably stay there now until we have other data that supports frontline use of pirto. I believe the sequencing that we're doing now is most appropriate based on the data that we have.
Carrie, coming to you, you know, I think what we're seeing more and more is switching between drugs. So if somebody's running into problems with one, maybe we switch to another. You know, if somebody's responding to a second or third generation but running into toxicity, do you go to another second or third generation, or do you go to Pirto at that point, or you know, how would you think about managing toxicity in that situation?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. Certainly, there's data. There's a phase 2 study looking at acalabrutinib and ibrutinib intolerance, and that was done with zanubrutinib too. And we know that if people are intolerant to ibrutinib, zanubrutinib and acalabrutinib are effective and usually tolerated, not always. If you have someone with like a near fatal toxicity, like a ventricular arrhythmia, I'm usually done with a class for BTK inhibitors. Now with the use of the second or third generation, I absolutely would try, you know, zanubrutinib if acalabrutinib weren't tolerated and vice versa. I haven't really had to do this much because usually they're so well tolerated, you don't worry about it. So unless you have a toxicity of a severity that you would not even risk that happening again, I think switching between the covalent BTK inhibitors is good. I probably wouldn't go, zanubrutinib to ibrutinib just because usually that's a less tolerable one. Pirtobrutinib, because of the different mechanism and kind of what Bill was saying, I usually don't switch to pirtobrutinib for intolerance to a covalent BTK inhibitor. But I think it is likely it would be more tolerable, but I still worry that the resistance to the class picture is going to be a limiting factor, and then people wouldn't be able to benefit from a covalent BTK inhibitor. But I do suppose if someone really couldn't tolerate any of the covalent BTK inhibitors, that would certainly be an option, and there's plenty of data to suggest that pirtobrutinib is effective both in covalent BTK inhibitor resistance and in patients that don't have resistance to covalent BTK inhibitors, in those that have never been exposed to venetoclax. But I think it's trickier to switch to a different mechanism of BTK inhibitor.
Great. Bita, one of the questions on here is skipping directly to Pirto after progression or so forth. So different question. We asked the question if it's a tolerability issue, how do you switch between them? It's a different question, though, with resistance. So would you ever go from Acala to Zanu or Zanu to Acala in the setting of progression, or do you go directly to Pirto in that setting? Maybe you could sort of highlight the rationale there.
Sure. So if someone, I'm truly convinced that someone is progressing on a covalent BTK inhibitor, I would not switch to another covalent BTK inhibitor. The current FDA-approved label for pirtobrutinib is patients who have failed both a covalent BTK inhibitor and a BCL2 inhibitor, but we are increasingly seeing that people find a way to go from directly a covalent BTK inhibitor to pirtobrutinib without the patient having tried venetoclax. I think it's a matter of style, in addition being kosher and compliant with the FDA-approved labels. I am an unapologetic fan of time-limited therapy, so even if I can, after the covalent BTK inhibitor, I can have some years of progression-free survival with venetoclax, I would prefer that rather than going on to another, potentially indefinite therapy. Going from just comparing the data in patients who went from a covalent BTK inhibitor to a non-covalent BTK inhibitor, the median PFS was slightly less than 2 years as compared to 1.5 years in the double exposed, double refractory patient population. I don't think there is a right or wrong answer. It's a matter of style, but I think if someone is truly progressing on a covalent BTK inhibitor, putting them on another covalent BTK inhibitor is not the right choice.
All right, Bill, we got a great question from the audience. I have no doubt that at MD Anderson, you get a lot of patients who come to you, second opinions along the way, and they're already on ibrutinib and they're doing well. So not a tolerability issue, not a toxicity, not a progression, they're just on ibrutinib. Do you ever talk to them about switching to a second generation BTK inhibitor, or are you content to just leave them on ibrutinib?
Yep. No, if they're doing well on ibrutinib, I'll leave them on ibrutinib. I think the bigger question for that type of patient is, well, what are my options to get off treatment? And we've done a trial at Anderson for consolidation with venetoclax where we've added venetoclax to ibrutinib to increase the depth of remission and get them off treatment. And our trial, I think 70% of patients converted to MRD undetectable status with the addition of venetoclax, and we're able to get them off treatment. So the conversation about consolidation and depth of remission and
strategies to get patients off continuous therapy is really the discussion that happens in that type of patient who comes in who's doing well, and I don't change them off from ibrutinib.
Farouk, you know, as people are moving from one BTK inhibitor to another, do you ever check BTK resistance mutations? What role does that testing have in routine clinical practice at this point?
Yeah, so I guess, again, it's a biased answer because our practices are different in an academic setting. So the patients who come to us are specifically looking for certain answers. Do I do it? Yes. Do you need to do it? Probably not in every case. I am more aware, like Bill said, was with the certain mutations that may make pertobrutinib resistance with the covalent BTK inhibitors. That is an emerging science. I also realized that the BTK resistance understanding is not an exact science because there are patients who don't have the BTK resistance mutations identified and still have progression. So, you know, for what it's worth, I am checking it when the patient is truly progressing because I have access to that. It's relatively straightforward. Am I using it in everyone? Yes, in my practice, and then I do decide if Berto is the right choice. So far, it hasn't been an issue. But is it prime time already? Probably debatable.
All right. Well, staying on schedule here, and thank you so much. We're going to move on to Bill's discussion of CAR T-cell therapy and other novel therapeutic options. Bill?
Great. Thank you. I've got a lot of slides, so hang tight with me, and I'm going to walk you through quite a bit of data. We've made remarkable progress in treatments for patients with CLL, and we also have a lot of opportunities now with new therapeutic developments, and this slide summarizes it, and it's not an exhaustive list of agents, but as you can see, there are a lot of agents that are currently in development. We have a lot of clinical trials open. They're predominantly for previously treated patients, so if you have patients, we're happy to have referrals. I'm going to talk about three areas. Liso-cel or the CD19 CAR T-cell, that's currently approved for patients with two or more prior treatments, including a BTK inhibitor and a BCL2 inhibitor. I'll touch on the BTK degraders, which is an emerging class of drugs that are looking very active and very promising. And I'll focus on BGB16673, but there are others, as I've listed there, NX5948 and the ABBV010. And then I'll also finish on epcoritamab, which is a bispecific CD20, CD3 bispecific, which I'm sure you're familiar with, related to other B-cell malignancies. So this cartoon summarizes the strategy of chimeric antigen receptor-based therapy, where the T-cells are transduced to express this engineered receptor. The engineered receptor binds to a target antigen, specifically CD19 in this case, and expression of this engineered molecule on T-cells will direct the T-cells to react against the target, CD19, and kill the target cell, the CD19-expressing cell, which is the CLL cell. The Transcend CLL-004 trial is the trial that led to approval of liso-cel, the CD19 CAR T, in patients with relapsed refractory CLL. This is the design. There were three cohorts. There was a monotherapy cohort, a cohort with liso-cel plus ibrutinib, and a smaller cohort with liso-cel plus venetoclax, which didn't expand into a phase two. So we have two main cohorts, monotherapy and liso-cel plus ibrutinib. There was phase one portion. Two doses were tested, a 50 million and 100 million CAR T cells, either as monotherapy or in combination with ibrutinib. And I'm going to walk you through the monotherapy, which is the current approval, and then I'll show you early data with the combination. Patients get apheresed. Production occurs over about a 3 to 4 week period. They get lymphodepleting chemotherapy, and then they get a single infusion of their engineered CAR T cells. So the monotherapy cohort, and particularly the approval, was in a previously treated patient population, and the focus was on double refractory patients, patients who had failed both a BTK inhibitor and a BCL2 inhibitor, and then went on this treatment. In the upper right-hand corner, you can see responses by an independent review committee for those double refractory patients who received treatment at dose level 2. So 100 million was the phase 2
expansion cohort, there were 50 patients, complete remission in 20%, overall response rate was 44%. There was durability to those responses, and so this is progression-free survival. If you focus on the right side, which is the double refractory cohort, you can see the patients who achieved a complete remission, the 20%, are doing exceptionally well. And overall, the median PFS was about 2 years. And so even patients who have a partial remission have a reasonably good, and remember, these are all double refractory patients, which is a very high risk category. The non-responders obviously did quite poorly. And then this is overall survival, again focusing on the double refractory patients, those patients doing very well. In terms of the side effect and toxicities, we think about CRS or cytokine release syndrome and neurologic toxicity. So this summarizes for monotherapy CRS, as you can see in the top left there, 85%. Most of those were either grade 1 or grade 2. Neurologic toxicities all grade and 45%, and then it was 19% for the grade 3 or higher neurologic events. So these are manageable. These are managed with steroids and or tocilizumab, and do require some experience and expertise in how to manage them, but are manageable side effects and toxicities. We looked and did an analysis of factors that correlated with response. And so for overall response there on the left and complete response on the right, high-risk genetic features did not correlate necessarily with poor outcome. So if patients had a high-risk feature, they were just as likely to respond, overall response rate as well as the CR rate, as those who didn't have those high-risk features. So this treatment does have activity in high-risk patients. What are things that correlate with response? Well, the number of prior treatments is important. The more extensive prior treatment, the lower likelihood of responding to treatment. So you can see, however, there are responses among patients who have had more prior treatment, but we think that earlier treatment or a less heavily treated patient population will have an improved outcome with this treatment. Also, bulk of disease correlated with response. The higher bulk of disease, the lower the response rate. If you look at side effects and toxicity, there wasn't really any predictors for cytokine release syndrome. For the neurologic toxicities, and particularly the high grades, interestingly, inflammatory markers were associated with higher likelihood to have a neurologic event. Also, renal insufficiency and bulk of disease was important there. So in terms of the combination, patients went on ibrutinib or were on ibrutinib already and continued ibrutinib. They had their apheresis. They could continue ibrutinib up to 90 days after their lysocell. The concept for this came from work that was done at the University of Washington and also by the UPenn group, where they showed that a more potent CAR T product could be generated from patients if they collected T cells while the patients were on ibrutinib. And also, there was some suggestion that there was a higher response rate when the CAR Ts were given while patients were on a BTK inhibitor and a lower side effect and toxicity profile. So this is the reason and rationale for this combination cohort. This is an earlier report. I have an oral presentation on Monday to update these results. This cohort was 22 patients. The update is going to be 56 total patients, 51 who were treated at dose level 2. On the left, you can see the responses by the IWCLL criteria. On the right is the MRD data. So there was a high response rate. Now, this data is generated by investigator-assessed responses, whereas the monotherapy data that we focused on was on by independent review committee. So you have to take that into consideration. But you do see an impressive response rate, including a high complete remission rate. And on the right, you can see a high undetectable MRD rate. And those responses also were durable and continue to be durable. These are the CRS and neurologic events, which it's hard to compare across the cohorts, but there may be a suggestion that there are lower incidence of those events. Ibrutinib does come with side effects and toxicities, and we did see those in some patients. Cardiac events and atrial fibrillation were seen, but there were no significant risk safety signals that were seen with the combination that were not anticipated, and there was good activity and tolerability. So moving on to the degrader. So this is a very important category of drugs. They function by binding to their target. In this case, it's BTK, and they facilitate and induce ubiquitination of the protein, BTK, again in this case, which ushers the protein to the proteasome, and the protein is degraded. And so that's a way of eliminating the target, particularly in the CLL cells. This is with BTK. So this is just an example of a phase one trial that's ongoing. BGB-16673 is a BeiGene drug that's in development. They did a ramp up in terms of the dose, and then I'll show you the responses. So these are the side effects and toxicities. It appears to be very well tolerated, not a lot of grade 3 or greater, and those are ones that we would expect in a previously treated patient population. Neutropenia, cytopenias, and infection is a risk. There is activity. If you focus all the way to the right, you can see the responses here for 43 patients, the overall response rate being 73%. This is the swimmer plot in terms of dose and response. And so this is an area that I would keep my eye on as very promising. And then finishing up with epcoritamab, which is a bispecific CD20, CD3 bispecific. These data have been presented at prior meetings. There's a cohort for relapsed refractory patients with CLL and also a Richter's cohort. This is a subcutaneous drug. It's delivered monthly for the first three cycles. Weekly for the first three cycles. And then for subsequently, it's spaced out to every other week and then once a month. So these are early data in terms of the activity and side effect profile. We do see some CRS, tumor lysis syndrome, and neurologic toxicities, but also with this agent, very promising activity in a heavily pretreated patient population. Again, limited numbers of patients, 63% overall response, CR and 33%. Deep remissions and activity, and so everybody's very interested and excited about this category of drugs offering promise for more treatment options for patients with CLL. So thank you.
Fabulous.
It's hard to imagine we've come so far, and yet there's so much like on the radar here that's coming to it just sort of never stops. Carrie, I'll start with you. And this is, I think the principle of this question is you've got a young, high-risk patient, sort of at the center of that question there is, should he be sent for transplant? And so I'll sort of ask, if you got a young, high-risk patient who's failed several therapies, how are you triaging allo transplant versus CAR T? Are you guys doing allo transplant? What's the role in that setting?
Yeah, so I think that these, the initial recommendation for, back before these novel agents for a young patient with TP53 altered CLL was to do FCR and get an allo immediately. And I think it's great that we're now talking about allo transplant after years of good quality of life for these patients taking novel agents. So just starting there with I love that this discussion has moved later. I do think, I was saying before, when patients have CLL that is resistant now to a BTK inhibitor and venetoclax, those are patients whose life expectancy will still be limited by CLL. These are the people that can die of their CLL still because, the CAR T and certainly the progression-free survival we see with drugs like pirtobrutinib aren't going to be longer than this person's natural lifespan. So I do talk to young, fit patients that have CLL that's resistant to targeted agents about allotransplant. In the interest of full disclosure, I'm not a transplant doc, so I do refer them to our transplant group for this. I do think CAR T therapy is worth trying before allotransplant, because if you end up in that kind of long-term remission group, then you could spare the toxicity of allotransplant if the CAR T is going to get the job done in the long term. And I have patients who participated in CAR T trials that are now 8 years after CAR T and still in remission that had double exposed or double refractory CLL. However, if you have a CAR T is not working, you know, patients certainly should enroll in clinical trials. But if you can get the disease sufficiently low for allotransplant, I absolutely recommend at least considering that. I have had very few takers on that. So I've discussed this with younger fit patients that said, heck no, I will not do that. I will enroll in every trial you got. I met with a transplant doc. I'm not interested. You know, the data on transplant in CLL is not spectacular. So this is not a slam dunk, even if people do it. And by the time, you know, this patient we're talking about, you're thinking about, is someone who's younger. But by the time people have gotten, you know, several targeted agents, some of them are in their late 70s or 80s, and transplant both is not great in that age group, and two, not really consistent with the goals of most of those patients. They're just not interested in something like that. So I do think there is still a role for allotransplant there. I usually put it after CAR T, but it's worth discussing and referring younger patients.
Super. Farouk, the patients who were enrolled in that CAR T study, the initial study, boy, they were a real dumpster fire, right? I mean, they had had every chemotherapy, every targeted agent, and everything else that you might have activity. So, I guess the question is that a low watermark for how patients do with CAR T? Is it possible we're doing better as patients don't have as much T cell exhaustion? Do you think that might impact efficacy if they're not bendamustined and fludarabined and so forth?
Yeah, I think the analogy would be our experience from large cell lymphomas and follicular lymphomas. The earlier the CAR T, the better the outcomes would be, partly for those reasons. Now, how early is the other question, and then what's the role of allotransplant? So just a shameless plug, we have a poster which has compared allotransplant, it's tomorrow evening, which we have compared allotransplant outcomes with ibrutinib. And that was the first time we've shown that ibrutinib use as compared to allo transplant actually improves overall survival, not just PFS. So, you know, this was a hypothesis that allo is curative, you can improve survival. So we've actually shown by comparing the RESONATE data in high-risk patients, in 17P patients, and comparing that to the CIBMTR data that actually allo transplant improves overall survival in patients. BTK inhibitors, ibrutinib improves overall survival in patients with 17p deletion as compared to allotransplant. So that's why allo should be deferred to the later lines therapy. Similarly, CAR T should be truly double refractory, even double exposed is arguable. So the ASTCT guideline committee is updating its 2016 guidelines. It should be coming out soon. That will hopefully clarify that issue on the use of CAR T and transplant in patients with relapsed CLL. At this point, it has to be two lines. The zanubrutinib patient that you just saw, zanubrutinib should work for a good 4, 5, 6 years in that setting. And then you have pirtobrutinib. The minute you switch, make that transition, that's when I start thinking about CAR T. That's when I type the patient and at least have the donors identified and then pull the trigger depending on the discussions with the patients. Definitely CAR T should be double refractory at this point. Now I would rather do it a little earlier than 10th line therapy, yeah, because that's where they would have the best outcomes.
Bita, this question is going to come to you, but it's based on something Bill said, and I just a piece of data I hadn't seen before, which is that the efficacy of CAR T is based to some degree on the bulk of disease, right? And so, as you think about maybe somebody with double refractory disease getting onto pirtobrutinib, how do you the question here is about bridging therapy to CAR T. How do you, in your mind, think about using pirto as a bridge, or when you place that referral to CAR T, or how you would do that moving forward?
That's a great question. You know, I have basically followed that approach that, okay, let's use pirto and then go to CAR T. The problem is patients enjoy the pirtobrutinib so much that they sometimes become resistant moving forward with CAR T because they're enjoying it, they're responding, but then we review the data. So, There is no right or wrong answer. You can honestly get all the mileage that you can from pirtobrutinib and then move to CARDI, or if a patient is agreeable that at some point, 1.5 years later, based on the data, their disease is going to progress, so why not do the CAR-T earlier? And again, cross-trial comparison is fraught with bias, but if you look at the pirtobrutinib CAR-T data for the double refractory cohorts, the median PFS with pirto was 16 months versus 11.9 months for that double refractory cohort. So if I have to use basically bridging therapy, I very much prefer ibrutinib because of the basically data that was presented by Will, especially, you know, if they haven't seen ibrutinib for a while, I just want to enhance those T cells before collecting them. But as you said, you know, whatever, sometimes I put them on a PI3 kinase inhibitor to debulk and then take them for CAR T therapy. But I personally use pirtobrutinib as an independent entity rather than bridging therapy because I think the data is still good.
That's great. Thank you. Bill, you know, for patients who don't respond to CAR T, or maybe I'll ask the question slightly differently. You know, if bispecific antibodies get out there more abundantly, do you think they'll compete with CAR T in terms of, you know, you're going to fail a bispecific first before you get to CAR T, or how do you think that's going to evolve?
So I think they will be an option that we'll talk about with our patients and in the context of relapsed refractory disease and in the context of making a decision about CAR-T and whether or not patients want to move on to CAR-T. One of the things that I'll be looking for is the long-term progression-free survival and time to relapse data and having a better understanding of is there a difference between the bispecifics and the CAR-T strategy. We see persistence with the CAR-T cell therapy, so one infusion, you can see CAR-T persisting out to more than a year. And that's been associated with better outcomes. So I think we need a little bit more data. We will have a little bit more data when the time comes that there is a bispecific available for us to use in CLL. But I think for me, one of the things that I'm really interested to see is what is the long-term outcomes for the CAR-T patients and how does that compare to the bispecifics, and that will be helpful in selecting and directing patients in the discussion.
I want to make sure I get to a question from the audience here. Carrie, I'll come to you on this one. Treatment holidays with BTK inhibitors. We see it being done a lot. Thoughts, feelings?
Yeah, so when I think about the word treatment holiday, we're not talking about stopping a drug for surgery or for a toxicity, but literally just saying like, hey, take a break from this. And I absolutely do not do that. These drugs were designed and studied to be given continuously. We saw that data that actually you showed, Jeff, where the response continues to deepen out to 7 or 8 years. I don't think just giving people breaks because it sounds nice is a strategy that is going to enhance their long-term outcome. I also think there's, again, not really definite data, but the suggestion that actually interrupting therapy repeatedly is what increases the risk of resistance there. So I do not give people BTK inhibitor holidays just because it's fun to take a drug holiday. If I'm going to stop a BTK inhibitor, there has to be a reason. And once I've stopped, even for toxicity, if people are in a good remission, but I know it's not going to be super long because they were only on the drug for about, like, you know, 2 years, or people that needed extensive surgery and had to be off the drug for months, I actually wait till the disease meets treatment criteria before restarting a BTK inhibitor. Drug holidays haven't been studied, and I think based on the limited data available, there's a strong possibility that they'll increase drug resistance, and no data, it prolongs PFS.
Well, great. Let's give a round of applause to our panel here. Thank you very much.